Well, good morning. We're all doing sort of a jump ball about who's going to go first here and introduce things. My name is Jim Enote, and I feel like I'm wearing a cap. It's like I want to tilt my visor a little bit, but it's not gonna work. But yeah, I should break out in the karaoke. Does anybody know Wichita Lineman? Let's see. Well, thank you for coming. And thank you so much for Susan and others for putting this session together. It's a very important one. And Rick, thank you for that beginning. That's a great opening. That really sets the thing. And I'll just open with our part, because we are a group that has been working for several years looking deeply at creating some guidelines around collections management, stewardship, care, conservation, all of these sort of things. And we've been looking at this for quite some time, and we thought this would be a perfect venue for us to introduce this. And we'll also have another session on the last day. Is it the last session of the last day? Yeah, wonderful. Where we will be talking about, again, creating guidelines for collaborative conservation and management of museum things. On my way over here, I was thinking about on a flight, and I was listening to the flight attendant talking about one of those things that you wear around when you're in the water, I guess if the plane goes in the water, and she called it one thing, a flight vest, and another person said, no, that's not a flight vest, it's a life preserver. Another person said, no, it's not a life preserver, it's a flotation device. And about three or four people on the flights had all different things to say about that. And it started as us kind of kindle some things in my head, too. I thought, geez, we all got these different ways of saying and describing the same thing. But not only that, it made me think about years ago, as I was working in museology, and I think it was around 1980, what's that, about 35 years ago, at the Oshawa Museum that I direct in Zuni, we wrote some letters to some museums asking about what Zuni items they have in their collections, and we got responses back that said, oh yeah, we have quite a number, we have a few, and what is your research proposal, and what things are you wanting to look at? And what are your credentials? And we said, well, we're just some Zuni folks that want to know what you have and what condition they might be in and so on. And we kept getting several letters back. And the door just got tighter and tighter. We just couldn't get that door open. Years later, yes, because of NAGPRA, that really pushed things forward, right? And we were able to get at least some binders, some papers that told us something about what's in those collections. But as we read through those, we saw some things described in very strange ways. We said, well, that's not what that is, and no, that's not what that is. And the classic one was at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science, where something was called a Zuni net sinker. If you know where Zuni is, we don't do any fishing like that. So we said, what the hell can that be? So we went to a drawer at the museum. We pulled it out. It was just a small axe head. And so we thought, there's something wrong here. And it went on. And so while I was on the airplane, I started thinking, I started writing, and something just fell out of me. And so that's what I'm going to start talking about here. It's going to be brief. And so after many years working with the museology, we continue to see items in collections disguised with mistaken and unsuitable interpretations. With so much error, many items gain false significance and meaning by the hand of outdated standards and practice. It is strange enough that things are removed from their local setting and context. Now they have been renamed and reframed in languages and contexts foreign to the place and people from which they were born. We are now finally witnesses to efforts that improve staid systems of museum classification and accounting. Let us bury the fit in a box orthodoxy of one structured and established system of classifying objects and archival materials. The current system is not even binary. It is not two systems, with one recognizing the other. It is one system. And I will say this: no one has a right to restrict what we name or label this thing or that. Inclusion of expert peoples representing the source of collection materials is the keystone of a collaborative movement. Welcoming and respecting knowledge of objects by the makers and users of the objects does not change the objects. Why must we even offer an explanation? Has a museum or archive ever created objects in their collections? In the spirit of Amitalani, the Zuni word for rainbow, and the name of a multiple museum collection database situated at the Oshawa-Awan Museum and Heritage Center, we will advocate for pure and virtuous collaboration. This is a higher order than many may be concerned with, and implies that collaboration involves reaching out and enlightening on equal terms to decentralize power and leadership and share problem solving. We will not oppose each other. Rather, we will enable one another and allow objects and people to speak. Through pure collaborative spirit, we will pay tribute to voices of objects as the objects should be perceived and understood. Clearly, many old conventions in museum collection management, lexicon, and conservation have lost their purpose. If the field of museology is truly egalitarian and moving forward, then there must be centrifugal answers to our problem. We will co-labor, collaborate from the fixed center. We are aware knowledges are transitory and fluid, and the old systems supporting only one way of knowing are themselves artifacts of humanity's misstep. A new museum conservation dialogue has emerged. In some situations, let us marvel in the beauty of aging things. In collaboration with the desires of source communities and makers of objects, we will respect that some items should fulfill their lifetime as naturally as possible. As we are fascinated with the age and seasoning of buildings and other structures, we can honor the aging of some items in collections. In this sense, some items will reclaim their destinies. We will pay tribute to the creative, the impalpable nature, and the spiritual dynamics of objects together with the science of materials and their environments. I believe the spirit of pure collaboration is a movement, and the number of colleagues that are attaining pure collaboration is additive and promising. These colleagues' works are principled and noble, and I applaud them and everyone associated with their ideas. We are informed by many years of experience. We are serious people, and we are thinking differently from those that served before us. Surely, imaginative and unfamiliar concepts will be met with resistance. But when the tide goes out, I imagine we will trust heretical notions as positive beacons that will enlighten the field of museology and manifest new accountability of all knowledges through pure collaboration. So thank you very much. Next.
So before we start our panel discussion and including all of you, I'll just give you a brief chronology and some context for this project. The initial idea for this project grew out of my experience as a conservator carrying out collaborative work in various museums with various conservators over about 25 years. It really started in Santa Fe with the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture, the permanent exhibit project there from about 1986 to 1996, something like that, where it was kind of a very progressive process and included community members from the ground up. And that was the first time, I think, that conservation really became part of that process. So good collaborative work has been going on in conservation, in museum labs and communities, and through video conferencing and so on. But I noticed the idea of what it means to collaborate differed quite a bit sometimes from museum to museum, and even within the same institution, from one conservator to another, one curator to another. And as Jim has noted, collaborations were happening, but how and with whom? And what does it mean to be truly collaborative? What are the goals and what is the nature of the dialogue taking place? Was that shift of authority and a power that is so essential to a successful collaboration really happening and to a satisfactory degree? How is the exchange and sharing of knowledge being documented, and how could it be accessed and by whom? With all of this increasing activity and interest in collaborative conservation and collection stewardship, it seemed an opportune time for conservators and other collections-based museum professionals to gather and take stock of where we were with all of this work and where we're going. So in 2012, I brought the idea to Cynthia Chavez-Lamar, who was then director of the Indian Arts Research Center at the School for Advanced Research in Santa Fe. Not only was she supportive, but the initiative aligned with her own longstanding interests. So she suggested that we think beyond a single meeting to a series of seminars that would address the issue of collaborative conservation and collection stewardship. And I have to say that without Cynthia's support, none of this would have happened at all, and my idea probably would have just remained that, an idea. So the first seminar brought together leading conservators of indigenous collections from museums across the U.S., Canada, and New Zealand. And the group also included curators, tribal museum directors, collections managers, and artists involved in the collaborative process. We discussed the profound changes in museums over the last 2.5 decades, including much greater access to collections for source communities and a balance of expertise, authority, and power, or striving toward that. And also an expanded definition of conservation and preservation that includes both tangible and intangible aspects of collections, and that has many ramifications. So this picture was taken, I guess, the group shot there, after a day of brain-stretching discussion and before we really knew where all this was going. So by the second seminar, things had loosened up quite a bit. Two major outcomes of the first seminar had been identified. So by the time we met again, our direction was pretty clear. So first, well, there were sort of two outcomes. First, in response to an expressed need in the field, we resolved to develop a resource to help those who are doing collaborative work or who want to, a resource for what to consider in planning and implementing collaborative work. Community members, too, lack a good reference to help them prepare and understand what to expect at a museum and what they can ask for and negotiate ahead of time and while they're there. So as a result, the 2014 seminar participants developed the first draft notes of a set of ethical and practical guidelines for collaborative conservation and collection stewardship, one for museums and one for communities. The second outcome and the topic of the third seminar is inextricably tied to the guidelines project and also addresses the need for more education and sharing of methods for carrying out collaborative collections work. The idea was to plan and carry out a workshop series on collaborative conservation and collection stewardship. And the workshop would also present the opportunity to expand participation in developing the guidelines. So to that end, a pilot workshop was held at the Sky City Cultural Center and Haku Museum in Acoma Pueblo this past spring. Most recently, a few of us met at NMAI for 2 days of intense work on the guidelines. Our goal is to have the guidelines for communities up on the web this summer. The guidelines for museums will follow. Last, I would like to say that the process of developing these guidelines has in itself been a collaborative effort, and ATOM is definitely a very important venue for bringing even more experienced people into this process and to help with the guidelines. So we're very much looking forward to your feedback and input today. Thanks.
Good morning. I'm Brian Vio, and I'm from Acoma Pueblo, and currently the director of the Indian Arts Research Center at the School for Advanced Research in Santa Fe. So we're going to do something a little different here this morning, and we've conceptualized this whole gig, so hopefully it works out. So how many of you have watched an episode of Charlie Rose? Please raise your hand. Okay, so you'll be familiar with this. We're going to follow something very similar. So imagine us as Charlie Rose for the next half hour or so. So we've identified some questions taking from the draft guidelines that we've developed thus far. And so we will be asking one another some questions. And these are hitting on some of the more critical points in the guidelines where we either require additional thoughts and feedback from folks like yourselves and or are addressing maybe some of the issues within the guidelines that we feel are very, very important and key to the actual introduction and implementation of the guidelines. So we're going to start with Cynthia, so she'll ask the question of Jim. Jim will provide a response, and then we invite the audience to participate in the discussion concerning that particular question. So we will moderate this as we move forward. So thank you.
Well, good morning. I'm Cynthia Chavez-Lamar. I'm Assistant Director for Collections at the National Museum of the American Indian. So great to be here, and I'm very happy to be in the company of these fine people. They're a great group to work with, so let's try to have a little bit of fun this morning and wake up a little bit. So those of you that know Jim here, he's a jet setter, he's a farmer, he's an interrupted artist, what else? A museum professional. he's a man of many faces. I think he's, what's that Dos Equis commercial? The most interesting man in the world. So Jim, in the museum field, he's collaborated with a number of different museums and has, you know, gone all over the world, literally, to look at various SUNY collections at different museums. So he has a real investment in this kind of work. So I'd like to know, Jim, why work with museums?
Well, I don't always work with museums, but when I do... I think, yeah, my work, along with some colleagues and experts from SUNY, have reviewed SUNY items in about 32 museums in different parts of the world. If you can imagine, each of those museums or collection centers had anywhere from 500 to 10,000 SUNY items. Oh, I think we've looked at several scores of thousands of SUNY items. And over time, we've developed our own sort of pattern language, where our own sort of ideas of what many things represent. And we've also developed relationships. After looking at so many thousands and thousands of things, we can look at some item in a collection and say, you know what, these are two of a set, and the other three are at the Kennedy Museum of Art. And the museums would say, really? I would say, yeah. Or we'd say sometimes, well, you know, there's this
photo, you have this apron that was made, and it's at the Denver Museum of Art. And you know, we have photos of people making these aprons.
Really?
Yeah. And we have, in some cases, we've seen manuscripts, written material about films that were made at Zuni, but in separate locations, separate museums and separate centers. So over time, we're understanding and building these relationships among things in collections, among archival materials and physical objects in collections. And we seem to surprise people. We say that, you know, this is a part of something and the other piece is missing, but we know where it is. And it goes without saying that sometimes we see objects in collections that, for example, at the Cambridge Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology, the Cambridge University Museum, there was an item that was called a bone pendant. And one of our experts at Zuni said, no, it's not. It's more than that. It's a turkey call. And this is how it works. This is how you can make it. And so on and so on. We had lots of rich contextual information to provide to the museums. The museums, many of them, still have, in some cases, paper or cardboard or whatever they are, those catalog papers that says North American, Southwest, catalog number, ID number, culture, place, wooden spade, something like that. And when we look at them, we have much more things to say about those items. Some very rich contextual information, how they're made, who uses them, what time of the year they're made, so on and so on and so on and so on. But even worse, I think, is that I remember at the Cambridge Museum, one of the teaching staff there had showed us some items, and we looked at them, and we corrected. We said, you know, these are all not what they are. And the fellow had kind of a stunned look on his face, and he said, a student just did her research on this. Just finished her dissertation on this material. And I said, well, how many degrees have you bestowed upon your students based on this wrong information? And he said, a lot. A lot. So it's in there, in the museum's interest, for us to work with them collaboratively to set the record straight. That's first and foremost. Equally, for us Native peoples, as collections and archival materials are being digitized and placed online, some of it wrong information, well, the digital media allows information to travel and be broadcast widely and fast. It also allows for that information to be, bad information, to be spread widely and fast. Wrong information. And our own people, young people and old, are learning about themselves and their own identities by going online these days. And what they're finding is wrong information. So it's in the best interest of our peoples to also set the record straight.
So you'll see on the screen here, we posted the question and some of the draft guideline information that we've developed over the course of these seminars, just some reasons why it is important to work with museums, work with Native collections and museum staff. So we invite any other input at this time from those of you from your own experiences or just your opinions, please. Well, thank you.
Hello. I'm Nancy Odegaard. My name's not on the list. I'm a conservator at the Arizona State Museum in Tucson and have been working with this group. And like Cynthia, it's been a real pleasure to get to know everybody and try to see us progress with the idea of collaboration in terms of conservation and management of collections. Like many of you, this process has been a process through most of my career, seeing how things have changed, how museums have changed, how ideas have changed, and it's a good thing. One of the areas that is very difficult is how do you, from a non-tribal museum, identify who you should work with? And I think there's so many highlight transformative moments for me, but one that I can think of is when asked to work with some archaeological material that was just not really identified at all, very fragmentary, and other issues with that, I had the opportunity to take advantage of another set of meetings where a number of tribal representatives have come to our museum and asked if they'd come over to the conservation lab and take a look and see if they had some opinions or guidance. And it was fairly informal. It was on the spot. And there was sort of a caution, an uncertainty on everybody's part as to what are we supposed to do now. But in the course of that, there was quite a bit of a confusion. And it wasn't as if the individuals came into the room and could say, oh, we know exactly what that is. There was a lot of discussion and unclarity. And one of the things that I could do as a conservator was to say, well, what were the pigments? And how was this whatever it was, put together? And those were the types of things that my area of knowledge could offer, even though I didn't know culturally what it was. But that started the discussion. And we had a very, very rewarding discussion because of what I could contribute and what I could hear back. And it changed the whole identity of what the object was and was a very moving and enlightening experience. So that made me want more of that opportunity. But I think it does come back to the difficulty is how do we identify who we should be working with? How do we have those relationships? And Jim, do you have some ideas on that?
Yeah, that's a difficult one because, in fact, sometimes I remember people saying, well, we should ask some elders to come look at these items. And I thought, well, not all elders know what these things are. You know, I know some elders who don't know jack, you know, about some of these things. But there's also concern, I think, to think about the people that may be contacted and invited to look at items because they are put on the spot also. So they might be someone chosen, and there could be some envy and other things going on in the community about why are those people going. It could be a tribal council member saying, well, I'm going to go do that, even though they don't know anything about the objects, but they've decided that they will be the ones to go, and so on. So there's some, I think, a real need for museums that are going to work with communities to take the time and think about the sensitivities, the dynamics within a small community especially, what is going to happen with those people as representatives of the entire community. Brian, do you have anything else you want to say about that? Any experience?
I'll just add that, excuse me, you know, one of the, I think, important things to know is the source community, the community. Know the makeup of, have a little bit of an idea of the community's makeup, of the tribal government structure. Do they have a museum? Do they have a THPO? Do they have some of these key individuals within the organization who can provide preliminary information and guidance on who the best contacts are at the tribal level? Oftentimes, museums and other institutions and even federal agencies and state agencies have the notion that, you know, there's this expertise at the tribal level that's accessible, and that they have experience in consultation, maybe as a result of NAGPRA or you know other museum-related projects or initiatives, and that's not always the case. And so it's really important to know the community before, or get to know the community before, you know, maybe embarking on a project. And as Jim indicated, you know, there's a dynamics, and I'm sure you all can relate to this from your own, those of you who are representing tribal communities, that, you know, internally, it takes some time to weed out who the best individuals are to participate in the project or participate in a consultation. So, you know, doing a little bit of homework and getting to know people first before even getting into the guts of a project is very, very important.
Yeah, I mean, as we were beginning to realize the relationships, it had been in our heads at first, and then we started making notes, written notes. And then we had our laptops with us. We started making notes there. But we've maintained notes. We have some documents, but those are kept at Zuni. With our new system at Zuni, we have a database at Zuni called Amitalani. And that one enables us to incorporate many different museum collections into one database system at Zuni. And so there, we can create some narratives. We can provide commentary about an object in many different museums. So we can select an object, look at it, and then comment on it. And we can choose, the power of it is, we can choose to keep it at home, or we can choose to share it. And because some of the things, not all, in fact, we don't really have that many sensitive things. We're not trying to work with the sensitive items because many of the things are art objects, art and photographs, things like that. But we provide commentary and we can share it back if we choose to. That's the power of it. And I think that's part of building a collaboration is having a relationship with a holding institution that says, you know, we can share back or we may not. But yeah, we're starting to keep those kinds of things, those notes. And but I think another level to that is building the relationships amongst the objects and the archival materials. That, I think, is really fascinating and exciting.
Hi, I'm Kelly McHugh, and I'm an object conservator at the National Museum of the American Indian, where I've worked for the last 18 years. So I like to say that I received my formal conservation training at the Institute of Fine Arts at New York University, but I was schooled at NMAI. Under the environment that Rick kind of described this morning, and I feel very grateful for that. And for my colleagues in the conservation department, Marion Kamenitz, Susan Heald, and Emily Kaplan, because over the last two decades, we've worked hard to try to increase collaboration as part of our working methodology with the way we care for the collections at NMAI. I have seen, though, my question to Brian is related more to the how. We've talked about the why and with whom, but the how is really important. And I think over the time I've been at NMAI and kind of tried to do collaborative work, looking back, I realize how in some ways uncollaborative it was in the beginning. We thought we were, you know, doing collaboration, but in working with this group of people, and I think in working on these guidelines, the effort is really to increase equity and to balance the power. And there is an inherent imbalance in just by the structure of the museum. So my question to Brian is really in the preparation for collaboration, because unless you have equity in the preparatory phase, you're not going to have equity in the collaboration phase. So what things, Brian, do you feel like are critical things for museums to keep in mind when preparing for collaboration?
Ever since the lights came on up here, there's this swarm of mosquitoes. So I'm trying to. small sacrifice for you all. It depends really on each tribe and each group. It will always be very unique, as you work with these communities. Oftentimes, unfortunately, institutions will contact a community and with the expectation that there would be maybe some immediate response, and that project is going to be underway based on the schedule of the institution. This is seems to be getting improving. I mean, there aren't many of these instances, but you know, definitely, you know, there have been situations. And I'll speak from the experience I had at ACIMA as the FIPPO, is, you know, during the NAGPRA phase, the initial implementation of NAGPRA, you know, we were receiving inventories every day for many months, and ended up with, I think it was close to 187 inventories, with about 40,000 objects total. And we had no idea what to do with that information. We had no idea how to approach any you know, visitation and collaboration with institutions who are sending this information. And on the other side of that, we were the institutions who were contacting us to follow up also, again, just didn't have any knowledge about who we were, our process, and nothing was accomplished. So many years later, and in my position as the director of the museum at ACIMA, and meeting with other institutions concerning collections, not only collection stewardship, but also exhibitions and programming, you know, we tried to educate these folks on our process, and the process at that time that was working very well, where we would meet with our advisory committee there at the Pueblo, who would provide guidance to the institution on just on the approach of the and implementation of a project where collections were concerned. And one of the things that was always key, at least for ACIMA, was that, you know, we needed to be very upfront about cultural considerations and our cultural calendar, and that what maybe they envisioned in terms of a project schedule was not always going to work well for us because of these cultural considerations and access to cultural leaders and elders at the Pueblo. So, you know, that's really one very important component. The other part is that, you know, sometimes we would be, it would be assumed that the tribe would make some sort of financial contribution to the process. You know, most of the time these institutions are very far away from ACIMA. And so, you know, while there might be some money in the budget for travel and maybe a stipend, meals and such, there was always the expectation that, well, the tribe, oh, they have a casino, they can provide the transportation, you know, these types of assumptions that would unfortunately be made by some institutions. And then, you know, the commitment, the issue of commitment of time. For the institution, as they've laid out this project, you know, they've identified their time and resources to conduct the consultation. On the tribal side, well, that commitment is a whole different issue, and you know, it's looked at it from a much different perspective. And these experts might not always be available, you know, the commitment of time to go look at the collections takes time. So in the case of the experience with SAR and IARC and Zuni, you know, this the first part of this process in terms of the collections reviews took, what, 5 years? And so now, you know, we're going to have some conversations about, you know, what are the next steps following the review? Are there some pieces within that collection that we can start to think about some conservation work on? And so there's quite a commitment here on the part of both parties. So those are some of the things that I think would be paramount in this process.
I believe that, I really believe deeply about collaboration, pure collaboration. And that as museums or holding institutions are working with tribal communities, that equity is so important. That in the old days, they used to be, okay, come tell us what we have. Tell us something about what we have in our collections. And that was a one-way street. Now I think what's important is the community should be saying, we want to see these things. Not what you want us to see, but let's work together. And sure, we'll look at some of the things you want to see, but there's some things that we want to see. And we'll work together on drafting, for example, release forms. If there's going to be photos or recordings, we'll work together on release forms. We'll work together on the budget. We'll work together collaboratively on every step. So it isn't just the institution saying, come tell us what we have. It's a two-way street.
I've had some experience with that, particularly from working with small non-tribal museums that have donors and community, little town individuals that they'd like to or possibly would want that collection. I've also worked with some tribal museums and cultural centers that are aware of private collections and with resource have been able to be very proactive to acquire private collections. So I think that's one of those things in my experience, not being the primary driver in any of those situations, but often in, I would say, being asked more as a kind of a technical, what can you look at these collections? Is there a problem, say, with pesticides or poisons, or is there, can you help us with the materials or other more material-based questions? I have become involved, and I think it differs, but I think it's this relation, the word relationship that starts. You kind of have a kind of a courtship that begins. In the Southwest, we have a lot of old ranching families that very often have a special room or a building on their property where things from their property or as they had money and means could collect. So as I've seen that, we've really talked about trying to build relationships in the importance and getting to know people. And I think once you know people, once you're friends, the discussion goes along. So it's getting past that first date that is the biggest issue in my experience with that. But I think it's finding people, initiating. It doesn't matter who starts it. It's just getting it started. And everybody saying, well, it'd be fun to know each other.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We had one last question for Cynthia.
I very much appreciate the discussion which has occurred, and I hope we can have lots more like it. I just wanted to point out just a couple of things as we kind of go toward the break. We'll have about a 15-minute break in just a moment. I have to tell just a little story. Yesterday at 6 a.m. in the morning, I was in Boston. I had to fly back to Los Angeles for meetings that occurred yesterday, and then I flew overnight to come here. So when I walked off the plane this morning, I was in a slight fog. And what happened was that just as I was leaving Los Angeles late last night, my secretary the assistant just sort of handed me the agenda and said, here's the agenda. Here's what you're supposed to talk about tomorrow. So now, against the backdrop of the presentations that have been done, which have been excellent, I would just like to make a couple of observations about sort of what I see in front of us, and it seems to be spinning out rather perfectly. First of all, there is a logic, if you will, to the way this agenda is put together. We have begun with first principles. We have begun at the beginning. We're talking about collaboration, and I'll come back to that subject in just a moment. And we are talking about it in a context of sort of opening things up between Native communities and non-Native institutions. And so you will see that the front end of this agenda talks about that. That's what this panel has been about. And then also this afternoon, the very first shot out of the box, we were talking about what non-tribal museums need and want to know. So we're just getting at that mix of things. And then we will wrap up this morning by talking about, well, how do you export what is learned in that process back into communities themselves with respect to training and educational opportunities. And then finally, at the latter part of the afternoon, we're talking about some of the nuances and details that flow from that, which relate to matters such as intellectual property and developing methodologies, which we are sort of doing along the way too, and how we restore, if you will, indigenous meaning to some of the objects that we're talking about. So there is a progress here that I think is important for us to note. We seem to be sort of following that along in any event. What I drew from the panel, which has just been completed, is the following. And along the way, we may try, either on my part or members of the audience, such as the very fine comments which were just made by our Canadian colleague, is the following. What you see happening, I think, it's sort of a three-step process. Lawyers, which I also am, are fond of talking in three steps. But you begin with a genuine bilateralism, a commitment to bilateralism between Native communities and museums. And that bilateralism is not just a process, it's substantive. In other words, it has to be entered into with a commitment to making bilateralism work. In other words, on both ends of the proposition, there has to be a receptivity to hearing views from the other end of the process, because that's the only way that you actually have the second step, which is true collaboration. And collaboration, again, has to be substantive. It has to be in a respect by turning the museological paradigm that I referred to in my opening remarks and that several others have commented on its head. Because that is a unilateral phenomenon, not a bilateral phenomenon. And so if you're going to get to collaboration, you have to enter into it with bilateralism in mind. So if you have bilateralism and then true collaboration, then, as Jim and others noted, you do have the mutual generation of knowledge that benefits all parts of the spectrum. And that's really what we are looking for. And you get into detail, such as there was a fair amount of time spent on, Kelly was asking, and observing, well, how is it that you get to some of the details of this? How do you know whom to talk with? And it reminded me of something that happened to me way back when at the NMAI, when we were doing the first set of permanent installations, permanent exhibits, and those were community-driven and community-based rather directly. And I remember that one of the first crises we faced, and you might have known it, was one of my dear Oklahoma tribal friends and colleagues, not Cheyennes, we do that too, but these were Kiowas. And they arrived, one delegation from the previous administration and the other half of the delegation from the new administration. And we were trying to figure out how we sort of settled all of this out and got the consultation actually done. And they said I had to show up. The director of the museum had to show up to sort of sort this out. And so I walk in. And as I walk in, an elderly Kiowa woman reaches out, grabs my hand, and says, "Now listen, I want to give you guidelines about how you should do this." And I said, "That's fine. What are they?" And she said, "Well, you just remember, I was your babysitter, and your father is still alive. And if you misstep here, I'm going straight to your father. So you just understand that before you're doing this." Well, that's probably not the full answer to how you construct collaboration in that setting, but it is an exemplar of the problems. And Kelly, what I would say is that there are no silver bullets here. If you have the substance of bilateralism and collaboration for a long period of time, then you end up having the processes which work. And I remember Marion showing me, even before I left the NMAI, the volumes that you had spread out across a shelf that were just the accumulation through time of mutually developed knowledge and data. And that is what allows you at some point to know what the details really are and whom you should be speaking with. And I know that at the NMAI, we kind of fumbled our way along sometimes because we didn't know that, because that's not the way the museum had been done, frankly. And so we were, and I remember that one of the members of the trustee whom I respected the most was, I can't remember exactly what I was talking to him about, but I was complaining about some problem. And he said, well, just, you know, be patient and quit looking down at your feet looking for a path, because it ain't there. You're creating it. Not just me personally, but the institution. And so that's, I think, the kind of patience. But that patience has to be informed by the substantive notion of the bilateralism and the true collaboration, which I talked about a moment ago. Okay. Thank you. And then we're just going to let the panel wrap itself up, and then we'll go to the break. Okay.
Thank you, everyone, for participating in this session, portion of the session summit. Just to wrap up, I just want to say that Landis explained the chronology of the work that has been involved to arrive at these draft guidelines. And later this year, in November, we will be convening again in Santa Fe at SAR for another intense seminar where we will discuss the input gathered during this session and our session on Saturday. So we will be refining and adding to the guidelines for communities. And as Landis indicated, these will be online next summer. And then we will continue our work on the guidelines for museums. So thank you very much for your participation today. And if you did fill out the sheet that Landis handed out, please leave those at your stations and we will pick those up. And thank you very much. Have a good rest of the day.